Hello, and welcome to another episode of Signals and Bits. Today's guest is Dana Boquin, the head librarian at the Harvard Smithsonian Institute Center for Astrophysics. Did I get that right?
You got it.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for being here, Dana.
Thank you for having me. It's exciting to be on.
So, what does it mean to be the librarian of astrophysics? Aside from this one time that I misread somebody's title and thought that their official title was the Galactic Program Manager, your title is probably the coolest I've heard. So what does it mean to be a librarian of astrophysics? Like what kinds of things do you get to do?
Well, I heard a joke, kind of someone, I don't know, there was some Twitter bot that sort of tweets out fake academic titles. And one of them was something along the lines of preservationist for old galactic computers. And it was sent to me because although that was a bot just making up words, it's pretty close to what I really do. So I think that when people hear librarian, sometimes they think of like a relatively negative, very old-fashioned, very wrong stereotype of, I guess, what we do as a profession. But really, the whole role of a librarian is to kind of facilitate your community's work. So if your community is like a group of public public school workers or something like that, or you have children and really what they need and the thing they're working on is learning how to read, your library should absolutely have story hours and really curate collections of books to meet that community's needs. But my community is a whole bunch of astrophysicists. So we're actually the largest gathering of astronomers and astrophysicists on the planet. Now I'm doing it. And a lot of the work then that I do is kind of geared towards facilitating their work. So instead of, I guess, reading to children and things like that, my community doesn't need that. They're doing a lot of theoretical work and a lot of computational work. And so my job is to make sure that we have all of the shared resources necessary so that they can do that work, but also that everything that they're producing, we're the memory institution of the place. And so making sure that all of that stuff, no matter what it is, can be captured so that future generations of scientists can learn from it. They have access to, and they need access to, all of these very traditional resources, but also they're creating all of these things that aren't. So we have to make new standards to work with it.
That's okay. So I'm gonna try to rephrase what you just said a little bit. So it sounds like you're responsible for sort of both curating and making the content available to your, I guess, quote unquote customers, who in this case are astrophysicists, but also taking the output of their research and making that discoverable and accessible to the future of your field.
Yeah, you kind of got to do both. And traditionally, doing both has not been all that different. We've been managing collections for a millennia. We've been kind of the models for the modern day internet. How do you share things and come up with standard protocols for sharing things? That's what a library does. And in the past, even if you're going from having scrolls or tablets or pots and pans, it's a physical object. It's something that you can tangibly take care of. So books, articles, all of these things that were kind of, you know, created with relatively small cohorts of people with a known way to steward those objects. We're just not operating in that landscape anymore. The whole information landscape has expanded wildly. And so now my community doesn't produce articles and books and things like that. They do physically still create objects, and those are important. But for the most part, the things that they're trying to share, the things that are their research outputs, are like code and data sets and entire models and environments. They're tools, they're applications. So now you're not just trying to share a description of the thing, because the description of the thing is not the same thing as the thing itself. And there is no agreed upon norms, so to speak, for how you describe these things, what they even are, what is the research object anymore? Is it dynamic? Is it static? What is the thing we're trying to share with each other? How do we archive it? And how do we make sure we have resources to help people do the work of making those things? It's a little bit of both.
So that sounds super challenging, especially given the fact that I think everyone I know, whether they're an engineer or researcher or, you know, graphic designer, they all use completely different things. They all use different tools and standards and protocols and specifications, and they're all producing things in very different ways. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to ingest all of that and make all of it accessible and usable by other people.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I would push back just a little bit on that last part is the ingest piece.
Okay.
So we're kind of operating for the first time really in the entire paradigm of the librarian or archivist documentarian profession, where mm-hmm. we're not the direct stewards of everything. So we're not ingesting everything.
Oh,
we're not being given all of the objects. We're not being told, here, take care of this. No one's writing in all caps on it and sticking a post-it on it or something and saying, this is important, and then dropping it off on my desk. So it's a kind of like a combination of discoverability. So we need to be able to be really good collaborators, because we're not ever going to operate in a landscape where we're going to have kind of a bucket where all of the things live anymore. And instead, we need to be able to find and make meaning and be able to change the meaning of those things over time. And so it's really more about standards and being a collaborator with the community now more than ever.
Oh, interesting. So part of your role then is also not only keeping up with the research and actively participating in the research communities, but actually sort of going out in detective style, finding work that has been done and making that work available to the community if it wasn't previously.
Yeah, so this kind of takes a couple of different forms that could be a little more concrete. Like right now we're going through a big project at the CFA itself where they're kind of rebuilding the website and all of these things, but we're systematically kind of discovering buried websites that are the only place where you might be able to find like the code associated with an old pipeline. So, and that pipeline may have been worked on collaboratively by different institutions with different funders, but maybe that code's the only way now to access these old data sets that have the potential to be recalibrated in the future based on new catalogs. So the thing that we're actually capturing isn't just like a snapshot of the website, but it's all of the metadata about that code, such that we could archive the code itself. So in the future, we know what it is, so we're able to give it some provenance, and then how it might be useful later.
That's really interesting. So there's two things that you said that I want to come back to. And actually, you talking through that reminds me, like I have lived through numerous examples where, you know, years ago, you know, my team or company had released something, say an FPGA image running on some radio. And then years later, somebody comes around and, you know, a customer will come around and say, oh, you know, we have this minor tweak. And the way that we had built that code, that PGA image, was in some ancient version of software that no longer runs on a modern operating system. We can't reproduce the operating environment. We literally cannot compile the old code, even though that code is in version control. We have no way of making a small change and then reproducing a minorly modified artifact, is the word that you used. I realize that that is a fairly esoteric problem compared to sort of the larger landscape that you were just describing, but reminded me of that kind of issue.
Well, that's exactly the kind of issue. There's actually like an entire field kind of coming actually from like the legal landscape and trickling now more into memory institution landscape called digital forensics, where it's actually like the practices of stabilizing and extracting data and other digital artifacts from old media. And one of the things that we're working on in terms of like standards is that, okay, well, everything is going to break. We know that. If we just operate in a landscape where we know everything is going to be broken, that gives us a sense of the kind of metadata we'll need for good tombstones, such that if we ever did want to like build you an emulator for your old FPGA platform or whatever it is that you built, we would have enough metadata to put back together what is needed so that you would have a kind of a baseline functionality so that you can do that extra little bit of work. You don't want, even though all these things are broken, you don't want an actual graveyard. You want things you can kind of resurrect ideally. But to what rises to the level of that kind of curation where you want it to be consistently stable and always actionable and like able to run whenever, versus something that you just kind of want to make sure it doesn't get completely forgotten and become this useless object, because one, it's something you made, so your code is actually speech. It's something that you did and that we can attribute to particular people and particular efforts in time. So if you think on like a 400-year time scale, we kind of want to know what you did and who you were. But also, you don't want something to just be marginally old and then all of that investment to basically now not be something you can capitalize on. With articles, just because they're old doesn't mean they might not be useful.
Right. That's really interesting. So actually, before we go too much further on, I want to go back to those 2 points. Whoa. So you used a word, provenance. And prior to having discussions with you, I don't know that I'd ever heard that word before. Could you just real briefly describe what that means?
Yeah, so provenance is something, I guess, if you go back to the idea of semantics. So when most people hear semantics, they kind of usually say this is like a throwaway thing. It's in the details. Oh, it's just semantics. Or they hear about it in like the landscape of the semantic web. And so semantic web, they know that it means something with like the knowledge graph or something like that, but they don't really think about what it is. And so semantics are the relationships between things, signifiers, phrases, whatever the thing we have described is, it's got to be related to something for it to have meaning. Because it just describing a thing in and of itself doesn't give it any relevance. Like I can say, an observer in astronomy, that means something different from generally someone who observes something, right?
Okay, yeah.
So if you're a non-observer, it doesn't mean you're not observant, right? And so there's like context matters. And provenance is basically like another way of describing all of that context. So it's all of the things that we're relating to our object. So like your code base, I need a lot of provenance. I need context to know why it matters. Because otherwise I can just describe the code base, but not anything about it.
I see. Okay.
So like I might need to know something about the language that it's written in, the operating system, maybe the kernel that you were using. What data sets do I need access to? Does it need an API? All of these little things that you can then attach to the thing you're trying to describe, giving it context, that is your provenance, that big bubble.
So ideally, these are all things that we've captured in our code documentation, but have almost certainly missed some part of.
Yeah, and so how did you document it then? Because it might be like in a README, so it might be a human action, a human readable thing. But how do we make it then so that it's machine actionable? That's when it comes down to going the distinction between something just being kind of written down on paper to being something that I could use to accession you an emulator, that kind of thing.
So that's a topic that I think is super interesting. There was one other question I wanted to ask you about your something you said previously. You talked about recalibrating a data recording, which is something that seems to be extremely important in astrophysics, but isn't necessarily something that we run into in other fields of, you know, radio or RF or, you know, software radio engineering. And the notion there, tell me if I'm describing this correctly, where when you're doing an astrophysical observation, you're calibrating the observation against known objects or bodies. And you do the observation or the experiment. And then later on, given new science or new observational capabilities, you can recalibrate that same recording against something new, or perhaps the same thing, but to a higher level of precision that might tell you more about the data or reveal something new. Did I describe that accurately?
Yeah. So for instance, one of the things we're doing is, kind of speaking of old formats and things, is we're taking a glass plate photograph. So we have in our collection at the CFA a little over 500,000 photos essentially of the sky over the last 100 years. So it's a full sky survey that was used to create a catalog, right? And one of the things that we're able to do now, though, is we're scanning all of those plates and we're able to pull magnitudes off of those plates over time. So what that means is we can basically, instead of just having a snapshot of a given star and what it looked like in 1910, we can compare it to what it looked like in 1920, 1955, 1985. So you can start to see how it evolves over that 100-year timescale. And every time we're kind of pulling that photometry off of the glass plate, you have to kind of calibrate it against something else so that you know, like, what is white? Because these are photos. Like, the background is going to be different. Do we know that the image that we're seeing right now, although it looks like one star, is it actually three? Like, because the level of certainty and precision and clarity we get by calibrating against different catalogs is going to improve over time. So although my catalog here that was recorded in the early 1910s says this is one object, Gaia happened, and now I know it's three. Something like that is something I can then incorporate into my understanding of how that brightness may have changed over time.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's also a good segue into one of the main things I want to talk to you about today, which is a project that you just kicked off, right? This is sort of a brand new effort, the Space Library. Yeah, so congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
That's fantastic news. So the Space Library is the Space Library itself is kind of an umbrella project with a couple of sub projects under that. Is that right?
Yeah, because we can kind of envision a few other things that are sort of going to fall under this effort. The idea being more broadly around accessibility and lowering barriers to making particularly small satellites projects more accessible to more people in more ways. And so the motivation behind doing that is we want to make sure that we can find communities and find these sorts of, I guess, dynamic research objects that are kind of on the bleeding edge and make sure they're accessible to everyone. So the small satellites are kind of like a microcosm of the issue. So we can say that, okay, we want to make sure that we come up with ways of archiving and preserving software. Okay, well, how does that then connect to hardware? How does that connect to the data sets that are used by that software? How do we build tools then that make it not just the scientists can use these things amongst each other, but how do we make sure that by making these things accessible, we're making it so that other people have pathways to using them, even if they don't necessarily have those backgrounds that might make it a lot easier to just step into this landscape.
Okay, so that first bit was what you described as provenance earlier, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So all of the connections, I guess.
Yeah, and so the second part is making it discoverable and accessible, even to people who aren't themselves expert astrophysicists.
Yeah, or engineers. I think that basically the Space Library is giving us an opportunity to flex a little bit and see, like, what are the limitations of the sorts of technologies we have right now in libraries and archives to capture and make discoverable these types of digital objects or born digital, born networked objects, but also then how do we make sure they're interoperable and reusable such that you don't have to be already involved in this landscape to learn from it or want to benefit from it or to problem solve in that landscape. So we've got, I guess, two projects that I could talk about separately. But
yeah, no, please do. So it's Metasat and the Library Science Technology Network?
Yeah. So Metasat is kind of like the first project that's under this like bigger umbrella where essentially what it comes down to is we're trying to develop something called a metadata schema that will make it so we can more clearly define what a satellite mission is. So I alluded to a little bit this idea of provenance where you have all of these different semantic relationships between what I call signifiers, so between the things you're trying to make meaning of. And in our case for satellites, you might have hardware, software, data sets, people, publications, whatever it is that you want to say, this is what a satellite mission is. We need to have like an agreed upon way of describing it so that you can use that information in other contexts. So like a metadata schema, you might be able to think of it like if you walk into a grocery store or something like that, and you know there are signs above the aisles, and the sign says canned foods are here. You know what that means. You know where they are. You know how to interpret that sign. You could compare this grocery store and what's in it to another grocery store, because you've come up with like a structure and places to document and define what that structure is, and you can navigate it now.
So what kinds of, is there a difference when you're going about designing something like that? Is there a difference in thinking about how that kind of thing can be used by humans, read and parsed and understood by humans, versus the same for a machine?
Yeah. So one of the things you want to make sure you're doing, so I guess like another analogy, so you have different kinds of metadata, essentially. You don't just have this structural metadata that I'm describing where you just have an aisle and you have signs where you put things in the aisle, you have food that you put on shelves. You have administrative metadata, you have descriptive metadata, you have architectural metadata. So you have all of the things that make it so a computer could be given whatever the rules are and work with those rules. So I guess another analogy might be like a board game or something. So everyone has to agree on what it means to win. Everyone has to agree on what, like if you're playing Scrabble, what are all the acceptable combinations of letters? And if you wanted to make it so a person, I guess, who only speaks German and not English, you want to be able to translate the rules of this game into another language, I wouldn't necessarily want just a person to be able to do that translation, right? Because there's totally a dictionary out there that does the translation for me if I can tell it where to look, if I can tell it what the acceptable translation looks like, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So obviously there are a lot of people running CubeSat and SmallSat missions currently, mm-hmm. and what you are creating doesn't then currently exist, this shared metadata schema for describing these SmallSat missions. What is the outcome of not having that shared understanding across the, all of the different CubeSat missions that happen within the scientific community?
Well, I think one of the things that's been hard to kind of explain about the project, because it's kind of like an abstraction and on an abstraction, and you need to keep coming up with kind of like analogies to explain it. And then people keep thinking it's a different thing because those are things they need. Like people want there to be a database that you could use to search across different satellites to see who also used the sensor, how many missions were funded by this entity in this year. Or people want an API that they could use to search different sources of that information. You can't do any of those things, though, without a metadata schema. So all of those things, like a database or an API or an archive, anything that you could want to actually do something with where all that information lives, you need a schema underneath it. So it's not like you need blueprints. You need the idea of blueprints and the rules for how to read blueprints.
I see. So everyone's sort of like thinking all these small set missions are happening and everyone is thinking, okay, they're thinking about the end thing that they need. Like I want an API that allow me to query data from some small set mission, or I want access to a database sitting in the cloud where I can pull down all of the design details from satellite payloads all made by some vendor. But in order for any of those things to be possible, this schema, the shared understanding has to exist. And that doesn't currently exist. So none of those end goals are possible anyway.
Yeah. So it's like this abstraction layer that if you don't have an agreed upon structure that people are implementing, or even like forks that structure where there are different rules you could communicate, you can't compare things. So you don't know without reading through someone's README whether or not something is in hertz or gigahertz. You don't know. You can't automatically do any of that. You could as a human read it, but you can't have a machine do that very easily. There's a lot of cleanup.
So one of the things that sounds most challenging to me about what you're describing is like how do you decide what's important, like to what level? Because if you're trying to record an experiment or an observation, as you said, we don't know what someone is going to come around later and try to do with that. You know, we don't know how these things could be useful in the future or what new processing might be possible with that data. So, you know, that sort of knee-jerk decision is, well, record absolutely everything possible. I mean, that's not totally intractable, even for the simplest of radio experiments, especially when you're thinking about sort of the sheer quantity of data that you get off of even very basic radio receivers in very short periods of time. And then all of the description of, okay, how was that recorded? What is the hardware that made that possible? What are the provenantial relationships, et cetera. So I guess for someone like me, or, you know, a hobbyist or some scientist trying to decide, okay, what information do I keep? What is important about what I've done? And what should I record for posterity? How do you go about making those decisions?
Well, one of the things we're doing with this project, Metasat, is actually trying to work with the community to figure out at bare bones, what are what we call the minimal elements that someone should describe right now to make meaning of what they've done. So for any component of a mission, whether it's, you know, you have some signal recordings, you have this, that, or the other thing, we're working out, like, in collaboration with the community at large, what should those minimal elements be? But you've touched on something really important when you said, like, well, we can't know what other people want or would want to know about this. And I hope this, like, gets people feeling a little bit less like this is a futile effort, because we've never known what other people might want to do with things in the future. One of the examples that I sometimes use in this context is, like, Galileo and Copernicus. Like, Copernicus wrote a book and, you know, people were able to dismiss it. And heliocentric model was not popular. And then Galileo, almost 70 years later, gets persecuted. His books are burned. He's in prison for life. He's threatened with torture. And it's like, why? He's just talking about Copernicus's model. And it's like, Copernicus didn't know his book was going to be very important, and Galileo didn't know his chicken scratch. Basically, his notes made it so anyone could repeat his observations. Now, all of a sudden, that heliocentric model is threatening. It's important because he could teach it to other people. He could prove it. And so now it's not easy to dismiss. So now the heliocentric model that Copernicus came up with, that matters a whole lot more in a totally different way. And now all of this chicken scratch notes that Galileo had, they matter in a totally different way. And they didn't have to know or care about what their legacy would be, because we knew how to take care of their stuff, and we could document their stuff, and we could add new meanings to their stuff. And so ideally, if you create a structure, if you create that recipe card, so to speak, and you tell people at minimum, you need to fill out, like, this list of ingredients and maybe this couple of steps so someone else can remake your food or whatever. You don't have to know necessarily that in the future, I'm going to have to know, like, what kind of oven you need for this if I can find it. So if a person like me in memory institution land can find your stuff and recognize what it is and say, oh, this was important, we can add that meaning back to it for you. You don't necessarily need to know these things if you make it so that there are hooks so people in my world can find it for you. We'll add the new meanings as they come.
That is a really cool example. So under the umbrella of the Metasat project, I guess, what kinds of communities, what kinds of small sat communities are you working with? Is this focused on one or more specific fields, or is this more of a, we want to, you know, enable all possible small sat projects?
Well, we're trying to go at this from, like, a couple of different directions. So within the Metasat project, the groups that we're talking to, really, like, overtly going and meeting with them are people who kind of already have systems in place where a metadata schema would be very helpful to all of the people their community or platform is trying to, like, serve. So we're working really closely with the Libra Space Foundation because of their platform and tools through SatNOGS, which is their, like, network of open ground stations. So they have this ground station network that anyone who builds a station can participate in, and then other people can take advantage of that system. essentially they already have a need for this. Metadata schema would make it so their database is a lot more searchable, and they could use a metadata schema too to improve their ability to do predictive modeling for scheduling observations. So there's a lot of reasons why they kind of already need something like this. Similarly, we're working with a couple of groups throughout NASA to talk to them about interplanetary missions. And so basically, we've kind of gotten to the point where we have our first interplanetary CubeSat with Marco from the InSight mission. And so if we know we're going to be having more things like this that are going to be like supporting bigger missions, how do those things fit into this bigger piece? But we're also going to be going to a bunch of conferences for amateurs. So we're going to be able to like ideally get kind of focus groups together where we talk to people who are more in amateur radio and kind of more operating ground stations themselves, because those are important components to all of this. And then in addition to that, we kind of didn't touch on it that much, but we have this thing called the Library Space Technology Network that we're building out. So the idea there is we'll put ground stations on public libraries. And so we give completely new communities, absolute novices, access to these tools and technology, and then talk to them a little bit more about what might be missing so they can understand and leverage and take advantage of these things. So kind of all over the place with it.
So for people listening who aren't familiar with SatNOGS, SatNOGS is run by the Libra Space Foundation, which I believe, Dana, you also mentioned, which is, it's a 501c3 that's based in Greece. And true to their name, they run several open source space-focused projects. SatNOGS is one of them, which is I forget actually what it stands for, but it's a global network of satellite ground stations.
That's what it stands for.
Yes, a satellite network of ground stations, where you can build a ground station entirely with open source hardware designs and running open source software stacks and connect it to this network. And if you go to their website, you can literally see a map of the world and select a ground station, you know, anywhere on the network and start interacting with it. And they also run several other efforts. They have funding from the ESA to run the SDR Makerspace, and a couple other things. So it's a really, really neat group. They keynoted GRCon last year, and that was a really interesting talk where they came and they talked about one of the things they're building are open source designs for payloads. And so they're testing different commercial off-the-shelf hardware, radio hardware, that was definitely not meant to build to be rad hard, and they're blasting it with radiation to see if it survives.
And one of the things, if you do go to their website or to the SatNOGS database and start clicking around on the different ground stations, you'll see that the different ground stations have different bits of information that you might be able to pull from them, and the different satellites may or may not record things the same way. And so they're working with us, and we're funding a developer to work with us through them so that we can take all of this work that we're doing with the community and this design work on this schema and actually implement it there as our first use case. So ideally, you have all sorts of different use cases you can use this for, but they're going to be our early adopters.
That's really cool. So you mentioned something about using this work with SatNOGS. You use the word predictive metadata, or I think, what was it, predictive observations?
Predictive modeling.
Yes, that's what it was. I didn't write it down fast enough. So that kind of touches on something that I think is super interesting about this work, which is, especially with the explosion of machine learning relatively recently, this type of metadata can be extremely valuable. And if it was recorded at the original time in a way that is useful to machines, when you think about it from the perspective of science and training over scientific observations or signal data or experimental data, there's all kinds of incredible things you can do if that metadata is there.
Yeah. So that new meaning that I was kind of alluding to, like, you don't have to know what it is, but if you give me a place to put my hook, I can put it there. That only works if you have a known structure to your data. That only works if you have like fields you know you can compare from one or another. So if I wanted to be able to say, like, okay, what is the likelihood that I'm going to actually hear something if I point my my receiver in this direction? Like, what is the likelihood that that signal is live? The way that you do predictions is you have to be able to kind of aggregate data from all sorts of different sources, right? You can't just do predictions based on one observation. You need many, many, many observations. And if you can't compare all of those observations and you don't know what about those observations actually gives you more information versus more noise, you're always going to be kind of modeling based only on, I guess, convenience. Like, if the only things you have to compare are, like, I don't know, two observations because they happen to use the same standards and record things well, your model's bad by default. So if you have everyone's information, though, able to be mapped from whatever they're doing to known quantities, you can now incorporate all of that information into your models because you know that you can compare them. And then you'll be able to say, okay, well, I know X, Y, and Z about these observations, but I really only need to know Z because X and Y actually are just adding noise to my model. So, like, it helps you actually figure out what's called information gain. What elements are actually adding value, but you can't do that. Like, your noise becomes completely irreducible if you don't know how to segment out the pieces, if you can't break them off.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So has the growth of machine learning in recent years changed things at all in the library sciences community? Like, has it changed anything about the way you go about your work or the way you think about your work, other than, you know, of course,
well, it's kind of like there's a few things. So, like, as a profession, we've gotten to the point where it's like, well, can we leverage some of these tools to do things like automatic indexing? Can we automate cataloging to some extent? These things that are just time intensive and you do need expertise to do, but are there ways that we can use these to our advantages in the field? But also, when it comes to just being good stewards of the work our community does, when it comes to machine learning, if the thing you're trying to share is a model, if the math you're doing is no longer frequentist, you have given up all numeric determinacy. You right. don't really necessarily care if you get the exact answer every time. You're not trying to share a data set anymore. You're not trying to share something static. You're trying to share something that has a function. You're trying to share your code base, but how it works. You're trying to share an algorithm. So we've gotten to the point where we're no longer talking about static archival objects, but you have objects that are kind of born networked. They're existing in many places in many ways over time. And we still want to be able to point to them overtly, and we want to be able to capture everything we can about them. So we're kind of operating in this new landscape where we're not, like I said, I think at the beginning, we're not trying to put all your stuff in a box anymore. We're trying to make sure we can map it all.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit more about the Library Space Technology Network. So I think I actually miscalled it the Library Science Technology Network earlier. You've given us a pretty high level description of it, and so it sounds like you're putting there's SatNOGS ground stations, right, on five libraries, and then making those generally accessible to the community. So what's the long term vision for LSTN? Are you hoping that others will join, that other libraries will find funding and build ground stations and join them to the network? I guess how do you see this building?
Well, I think that it's kind of like, it's going to depend. So this is all part of a pilot.
Okay.
So we wanted to, with our design of the metadata schema, make sure we weren't building something that would not be accessible to novices, or that it had errors built into it that were going to be barriers to new members of the small satellite community. And so the best thing we figured we could do is we could get feedback from people who have never gotten the chance to work with some of this stuff so that we can kind of make it more user-friendly, and also so that we could get a better sense of what would be needed to scale it up. So we're starting with five libraries, one public, one rural, one southern hemisphere, one eastern hemisphere, and one big research center, us. And ideally, we get to the point after a year of trying this out in these different contexts, we get a solid understanding of what information and resources would be needed for a community to fully benefit from having one of these things on their property. So we don't want to kind of operate in a landscape where we're using public libraries to subsidize access to tools that they're not benefiting from. And so we want to make sure that we're giving people agency in kind of defining what would make it so that this is valuable to them.
That's awesome. So it sounds like really the long-term effort is cultivating, not to overuse the word, but cultivating a strong network for community science and STEM and accessibility to science from all over the world.
Right.
That's awesome. So are there aspects of this work that are going to be happening in the public? Like, how is there a way that people can find your work and track it as it goes on?
Yeah. So right now, if you just go to Wolbach Library or CFA Library, there's a project page that's just called Space Library. And that's just for now kind of the landing page we've got for these things, because they are kind of brand new initiatives. But we're going to be putting this under kind of a new sort of page that'll be kind of called Wolbach Labs, because we've got a lot of different projects going on that don't quite fit into, I think, what a traditional library does. But the parts that are going to be like more in the public where you might be able to kind of interact with us, we are going to be doing outreach at these public libraries once we actually have them all selected. And so we're thinking of one in, we have Cambridge Public Library, just our local library here working with us, but we're also looking for a rural library in the United States. And we're probably going to be working with a group in sub-Saharan Africa and another in India. So actually doing outreach at those libraries in particular, if you've got listeners in, like, I don't know, who have a library in mind that would like love a ground station, we'd love to give you one. But also at different meetings. So we're considering GRCon, and we're going to be at the AGU. We're going to be at the Interplanetary CubeSat mission meeting in DC. We're going to be at COSPAR in Israel.
That's awesome. And just to add some clarity, the Wolbach Library, that's Wolbach, right?
Yeah.
That is the library at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, the CFA.
Yeah, so that's my library. That's where we have like our home base for all of our projects and stuff. And if you're interested in metadata or any of the things we're working on outside of small sats and things like that, we're also doing work on women's history and in effort to get all of that like glass plate data I alluded to earlier, to make it so you can find that stuff through like the modern astronomy literature. You can go online and transcribe on the Smithsonian Transcription Center all sorts of notes. So we do have some other crowdsource projects that are further along. And so if you're interested in kind of helping build bridges between that kind of historical work and what scientists are doing now, there's places you can help.
That is really cool. So, and Dana, actually, if you can provide links to those, I'll put those in the show notes. So anybody that looks at the podcast will be able to see that. We're out of time. Thank you so much, Dana. And this is really, really cool. I am unaware of any other project in the radio world that is doing the kinds of things that you're doing. This is really interesting. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for letting me ramble.
This has been another episode of Signals and Bits.